Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined with my usual co-host, Brian Brushwood.
Hello.
Justin Robert Young.
Hi, friends. How are you?
And we've also got one of our favorite guests of all time. Probably you know that because like we rarely have people back. But no, this gentleman here, deputy editor of Mashable?
Correct.
And at Future Boy on Twitter and all the social networks, author of my favorite nonfiction book of all time, probably, is Mr. Chris Taylor, author of How Star Wars Conquered the Universe. Available in paperback right now. Get it.
Hello. Hello, everyone. It's good to be back.
So, Chris, we had you on because we felt bad because you wrote a book about a topic nobody cares about. And, you know, it's just one of these things where you chose something that was a niche thing that really wasn't getting much attention in the media and whatever, and you put your heart into it, and we appreciate that. And we just hope we could reward you, and maybe your subject matter will catch fire. Maybe other people take an interest in it. I wouldn't count on it.
I don't know why people aren't paying attention to Star Wars. I mean, I know it's, you know, it's a dull, dry topic that, you know, may distract from your daily media diet of reading about foreign news, but let's just try to focus on the important things, okay?
So, I'm sure Noam Chomsky has a theory on this, I'm sure.
You know, from somebody that spent so much time researching, you know, the Star Wars in general, but you spend a lot of times on the prequels and kind of what that meant for the franchise. By any available metric that you saw in researching it, are we more or less in hype mode for The Force Awakens now 3 weeks out than we were at a similar time in 1999, from your opinion?
No, I think this is 1999 all over again. I think that if there is a difference, it's the fact that just the marketing machine has become more coordinated. It is easier to instantly see a trailer online instead of spending 2 hours downloading the Phantom Menace trailer on a 56K connection. Not that I'm one of the people who did that. but it is, you know, it's launching simultaneously around the world in multiple countries. I believe, you know, England gets it slightly ahead of everyone else, but, you know, then you've got to consider that, you know, France is getting it as well. I mean, it's sort of this rolling Star Wars wave that's going to go around the world on December 17th, 18th.
Well, it seems like, thinking back to 1999, this is back when I still had a day job and there was a superior internet connection there. In fact, at the time, the hype around The Phantom Menace was one of the first times I was able to stream and download relatively high quality video content at the time. And you had specials on, you know, Fox News with dubious content, like the Under the Dome special about the psychology of R2-D2's fictitious prima donna persona.
Loved Under the Dome. That was one of the best mockumentaries they've ever done.
Well, but on top of that, they had all of these small segments where, you know, they would show, you know, the day that George Lucas sat down to a typewriter, and it almost seemed like folks over at Lucasfilm were working in collusion, I would say, with TheForce.net, where every single day there were three or four posts of the latest names that were leaked or whatever. If there's a difference between the atmosphere now and the atmosphere then, it feels like they're a lot more savvy about giving less and making us want more. Because at the time, the hype around The Phantom Menace ended up being more enjoyable than The Phantom Menace itself. Whereas I feel like there's a very intentionally measured tone about what's officially released.
Yeah, and I feel like there was. In fact, I think that was the case until fairly recently, where it switched over from being Lucasfilm marketing in the driving seat to Disney marketing being in the driving seat. As soon as Disney came along, I think things got a little loose. Unfortunately, you know, you would see promos showing up on the, I don't know if any of you watched the horrible ABC block where they did their Shonda Rhimes block of programming, and they They made it a Force Awakens block. They had the cast of Scandal and Grey's Anatomy talking about how much they loved Star Wars. And then right at the end of that three-hour block, they finally give you this new trailer. But then that trailer did not go up online. You know, whereas Lucasfilm was very good about saying, here's the trailer, now everyone in the world is going to see it at once. You know, it's not just going to be all of us dweebs at Star Wars Celebration who get to see it. Everyone gets to see it. The same thing with that behind-the-scenes footage they released at Comic-Con. But now that Disney's in charge, it seems that they're holding back a little bit. You know, we didn't see that ABC trailer for, I think, about a day after it screened on TV.
Well, you know, part of the reason is that their ad campaigns right now are still changing. So what came out 2 days ago, they're deciding what they're going to release in the next 3 days. They're looking at, like, they're saying, okay, are we going to focus more on this character because it played well with young men? And as they're doing stuff in, let's say, blocks to try to hit – you know, we're sold. You know, my brother's like, why are they still putting trailers? I said, because they want your wife to tell you she wants to see it. It's not about us anymore. It's about everybody else on the planet. And one of my friends who works for Disney says it's frustrating because they're trying to plan a week out or 2 weeks out stuff that's going to be going out in other properties. But they don't know. You're like, well, we don't know if we're going to release this yet or whatever. We're waiting until Monday to get this data. And it's just constantly changing, and he's in constant fear that they're going to show him stuff that he doesn't want to see too.
Don't show me that.
See anymore. Yeah.
Well, we did just get the, you know, one of the big pieces of news this week was that the invites went out for the world premiere on December the 14th.
And, check my mailbox.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to seeing that because, you know, then there are going to be those 3 days where I have to decide how much to talk about it with other people, and it's almost worse to see it ahead of everyone else for that reason.
Are you invited to the premiere?
Yep.
What?
So you are going to a man's Chinese theater there and seeing the premiere on the 14th.
Believe it's going to be El Capitan, but they haven't said that.
But the important thing is
this is so famous that, I mean, you know, it's such a no-brainer that you're going to accept that invitation. They didn't even give a location. It just said Hollywood, California.
Yeah. El Capitan's fun, but it would be my first choice to see it.
The important thing is
that would be the most Andrew Mate thing of all time to decline an invitation to the premiere of Star Wars because he was not pleased with the theater.
Man's Chinese or go home.
Yeah, they're doing – so El Capitan, for those who don't know, is actually a theater that Disney owns in Hollywood. And if you go see a Disney film there, they will very often do really cool shows beforehand. And do you know what they're doing for this one, Chris?
No.
I'll grab the flyer. I'll be right back.
Okay.
Real quick, Brian, I think I cut you off there.
Oh, that's right. I was just saying the important thing is how many plus one, twos, or threes do you have on that invite that you're able to bring? And how are they for sale right now on eBay?
You know, I was concerned that I was going to have to take my our entertainment editor rather than my wife. Because he didn't get the invite till like 20 minutes later. So there was a period of time where... You know, my wife was very concerned that she wasn't going to get to go to this. So, yeah.
So, this is the first part of like what the El Capitan. That's the big flyer that says, "Hey, buy your tickets to see El Capitan." You open it up and you get, bam!
Wow!
Your face.
Nice.
For the audio listeners, you're seeing a full bleed shot of an explosion on Jakku.
Correct.
So what they have going on is that they have apparently something called like for Big Hero 10 or 6 or whatever that was,
six. Yeah.
Which I loved. They had Baymax came out and danced, which was all right. But for the Muppet movie, they actually had Kermit and Miss Piggy sing The Rainbow Connection, which was amazing.
Wow.
For this, we get what's something called a lightsaber curtain show.
Wow.
Which...
Laser curtain show.
So is that? Do you suppose that's a choreographed fight scene with lightsabers, or just a laser show?
I think it might be a laser show with some Lucasfilm sound effects. That's what I would guess based on that picture.
The irony
being that so many theaters now are saying you can't bring a lightsaber.
Oh, really? You know,
no fake weapons. I've seen this. I think Cinemark put up these posters saying no fake weapons allowed. you know, and it, and
well,
it
went, well, you know what the brackets, solution is that
blasters slash lightsabers, like, you know, as what, if they're the same thing.
The solution is that everybody should bring laser pointers. They're like, yes, virtual lightsabers, and I'm sure that'll disturb fewer people.
Finally, we'll bring it back to 1999, whether or not anybody wants to or not.
That was actually in the news when Phantom Menace premiered in 99. They also had a bill go through, I believe, the California House banning laser pointers in theaters and classrooms. Yep, there it is. There's the passes. No face coverings, face paint, simulated
weapons. I remember being convinced that there was no way to stop the laser pointer infection, but it just sort of went away. I can't remember the last time I went to a public event that anyone pulled out a laser pointer at.
I think it kind of went out of fashion. As soon as it wasn't a technical novelty, it's like, you are the biggest nard on the planet if you bring a laser pointer just to screw with something.
It's
like
the same as just screaming in the middle of a quiet concert.
Yeah, nobody's like, oh, LOL, that's hilarious. Look, there's a dot there. Chris, since the last time you were on, I think we've just naturally built a reservoir of Star Wars questions for which we would like to ask you, and I'll start things off with this.
Bring them on.
George Lucas has been in the news over the last week talking about Star Wars and him letting go of it as a breakup, and that there was an element of trauma to it. You spend a lot of time in How Star Wars Conquered the Universe telling the story of George Lucas and his very complicated relationship with this property. Where was the script for Episode 7? I don't know if it was called Force Awakens at that point. Where was that script? Was there like a line by line people could do a table read script, or was it just bullet points that Lucas handed over?
There was a treatment, and he actually had to be persuaded to hand it over. He initially expected Disney to give him $4 billion with, you know, sight unseen, without actually seeing the treatment for episodes 7, 8, 9, because I think he'd work out treatments for all of them. And they had to persuade him. They had to say, no, we're not going to give you this money until you actually show us the treatments. And he was saying, no, trust me. And I'm sure they were in their minds saying, no, George, we saw episodes 1, 2, and 3. We don't trust you. So that's where it was, but I think it was fairly early on in the process that they kind of abandoned his treatment idea. I think it was very much no harm, no foul. He's actually talked about it before. He talked about it in the publicity for his very, very bad animated movie, Strange Magic. He was asked, again, you know, wherever this guy goes, he's asked the Star Wars question. And he said then, yeah, Disney have thrown out what I did, so... You know, and he seemed at peace with it then, and you know, it is like a breakup. He made that metaphor with Charlie Rose, and I think it was perfect. It was like, you know, you don't drive by the house. What he neglected to mention was that he's actually been talking on the phone with J.J. Abrams quite a lot, and that they're quite friendly. And George has a cell phone now, which is a pretty big deal.
It's an advancement. Welcome to the million years ago. So here's what's interesting to me. I was part of, and I think you touched on this in How Star Wars Conquered the Universe. You talked about the fact that upon acquiring Lucasfilm, Disney sort of just, you know, issued this edict that all of the expanded universe was apocryphal, that was a new category we're calling legends, which means folklore around the campfire. It doesn't count. It's not real. The only things that are real are the prequels, the trilogy, and our current cartoons showing on the Disney Channel.
Correct.
At the time, I was somebody who was very, very upset. I felt like I had invested years and years of watching some of the world's most talented science fiction authors construct, you know, this strange and wonderful hodgepodge universe where they made excuses for all of the bizarre stuff that we saw. You know, how can parsecs be a unit of speed measurement and so on? At the time, I felt really gypped. And yet, on the eve of The Force Awakens, I realize the other side of that. Now that I've paid the price of my disappointment of having the expanded universe yanked from me, all of a sudden I realize that I have the gift that I haven't had since 1983. Going into all the prequels, everybody knew exactly what was going to happen because they gave all the secrets out ahead of time and because all it was fulfillment on promises made 20 years earlier. Now I get to go into a Star Wars movie honestly having virtually no idea what I'm in store for. Do you think that that was their intention? Because I realized not only do I get the mystery of not knowing what's going on, but also now if all of a sudden a mysterious blue-skinned, glowing, red-eyed alien admiral shows up, I will be beside myself. Whereas before it would have just been like, yeah, bro, I read it in the books. But by telling me the books don't exist, all of a sudden I have the chance to be really excited about something, a cameo like that.
Yeah, I mean, you can have the possibilities are endless at this stage, and that was something they mentioned at the time when they put that post up explaining why the expanded universe is going away. One of the things was we didn't want to be creatively limited in Episode 7, and I think that's absolutely right. I mean, but what they also made quite clear was that we can mine the expanded universe for spare parts, and you know, everyone's wondering where Luke Skywalker is. I wouldn't be surprised if we find out in this movie or next movie that he's been spending a lot of his time with a certain red-haired lady. And, the fans would just lose their minds, right? If it turns out, Mara Jade is in this thing after all.
Avengers crossover Scarlett Johansson.
I mean, it makes sense. This is like the Patton Oswalt thing where he was talking on Parks and Recreation about the crossover with the Marvel Universe.
The expanded universe, a lot of it's fun, but there are a lot of inconsistencies in there. And the last thing you want to be, if you're J.J. Abrams and Lawrence Kasdan or something, like, all right, yeah, this guy we paid $10,000 for, or a little bit more, to write one of these books, he gets to decide, when George was late at night at 3 a.m. said, yeah, kill Chewie. Sorry, that's fact, And it just to have to decide the fate of a humongously multi-billion dollar franchise on what was already written, which some of it's good, a lot of it's not good.
Well, there is. I mean, I've described it often as kind of a very drastic amputation to avoid a reboot later down the line. They chop the limbs off, but the patient is still alive. So much of the expanded universe canon was pretty awful, and I think that the new story group at Lucasfilm wanted a tighter control over what was going to happen. Even the folks inside Lucasfilm who've read every book don't necessarily like the expanded universe. But we already know, by the way, that I don't know how far we want to go into spoiler territory here, but J.J. Abrams has talked about it quite openly. The super weapon that shows up in The Force Awakens is actually something out of the expanded universe.
Well, and there's a part of me that could go along for the ride on this, because if you think about it, similar to the Greek mythology legends of old, it's like everyone would have the story of the one time Hercules came rolling through town, and no matter what campfire you're around, they would all insist it happened in that cantina right over there. And it seems like these larger than life characters from the Star Wars universe would certainly have stories about them told throughout. So to me, I kind of don't mind it just being in the legends category. That's what everyone says in this planet.
And they seem to be making use of that in the new film as well. That whole line of there are stories about the Jedi, about the dark side, and Han Solo has to say, yes, it's all true. So I like that they're playing with the mutability of stories and the way that they get exaggerated.
So, Chris, as things have spun up here, and we have begun to see not only more of this story through trailers and clips, but also the fan reaction has kind of built up. Has there anything that's been really surprising to you following this franchise as close to it as you have?
I'm actually surprised, and I think Lucasfilm is pretty surprised as well, that we haven't had more overt leaks. Everyone who reads makingstarwars.net pretty much knows everything that's coming up in the new film. That guy has excellent sources. He's been proved right time and time again, so you can pretty much find it if you want it. But other than that, it's like it's not common knowledge. The spoilers of the film are not common knowledge. And there were certainly people on the inside of Lucasfilm who I spoke to about 18 months ago who said, you know, we're going to be a year out from this thing and everyone's going to know the plot line. You know, that was their fear. And I think that even though the information is sort of out there, people don't want to know it. And that is surprising to me.
Well, we've seen, I mean, compared to 99, we're in a totally different culture in terms of movie journalism online, right? Which is where theoretically you got so much of that. I mean, 99 was the heyday of the Ain't It Cool News, you know, scoop in all caps, you know, just script reviews and stuff like that. Where, you know, we had a, you know, this week there was a very fascinating thing where reputable, I guess, but lesser known superhero blog reported who Star-Lord's parents were going to be in the new Guardians of the Galaxy. James Gunn comes out and says, number one, they're wrong. And number two, why is this a story? Like, why is this something that we want to report on? And you saw a lot of other larger movie blogs. I mean, I'm sure probably to protect their relationship with a very forthright James Gunn, come out and stand with him that this is not a story, that the plot spoilers are something that can be found, but they're not going to get the play at the top rungs of movie journalism in the same way. And I mean, I guess that's probably the difference, right?
Well, yeah, part of it is we've less tolerance for people who get it wrong. I think because we have so much more information out there right now that wasting our time on, you know, incorrect spoilers.
Oh, so you think that maybe it's for, you know, it's that element of like, well, we don't want to get burnt in case this is not a correct leap.
Well,
I think part of it is like, I think we've had enough experience. It doesn't make it better to know, you know, it's that, you know, we've had enough times where we've gone into things knowing and gone like, yeah, wish I didn't know that. Wish I didn't know that. Wish that was a surprise.
I don't think I want to pin it on a massive cultural awakening that we have so much as I think it boils down to I think it boils down to the artist has made it clear that they've wrapped a present for us, and they've made it clear that you'll enjoy the present much more if you leave it wrapped until Christmas Day. And I think that's all it takes. Whereas in 99, I don't think that was the culture. I think there was some kind of – there was a culture of pro-leaks, pro-hype, pro-everything, you know, working with the likes of TheForce.net and so on, that I think is – I think it's the equivalent of back in the day we had the Grateful Dead saying, yeah, man, bootleg every single one of our concerts. Go, 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 go. And so people did. Whereas now I think people are saying – you know, or Disney is saying, you know, look, we're trying very hard to craft something special for you. It's only going to be special if you get surprises. So why don't you play on board? I think people are going along with that.
I think it's Lucasfilm that is saying that. And I think that Disney is sort of excited to get as much of it out there as they possibly can.
I think that we're a generation that grew up earlier on spoilers and it didn't pay off. As much as I like to think it's this respect, well, that's the way the artist wants it to be done. I don't think that's the case. So I think it's just that in our little primitive reptilian brains that, well, when I went in and I heard this and then it happened, I didn't like it as much. And it's not going to be as fun as the little twist or the surprise that come along.
Well, I think it can certainly be you know, elements of both of those in terms of, you know, if you're the site, then you determine whether or not the headline – here's the big twist from The Force Awakens is going to help or hurt your site and whether or not the clicks that you are going to get on it. And so I think, Andrew, you're totally right that, like, you know, now I have less of a desire largely because there's better genre stuff out there. You know, I think the reason why I used to read as many script reviews and stuff as possible were because, you know, pre-X-Men, right, or Blade before that, like, you know, most superhero stuff was garbage, you know, and people didn't take the character seriously. In a world now where it's like, now we're looking at Batman v Superman and saying, too serious, maybe too serious, maybe we need to dial it back and throw a few more jokes in here. I think it's far more likely that I'm just going to walk into a movie and like it as opposed to it just being a soulless sucking cash grab. And even then, if it's like, you know, not to name any Fantastic Four names, you know, if it's something super disappointing, then, there's just red flags on it going into it. And then the reviews will be negative.
Well, on that note, Chris, we were at Star Wars Celebration and we were decided to just from the hotel room, though, watch the yeah, the part of the big announcement and all that. And then we noticed that they said, oh, a certain director's got the flu, you know, and you're thinking like, man, of all the things that you would, you know, show up for, mm-hmm. announcing your own Star Wars film, you know, there, any,
you're talking about the, oh gosh, what's his name?
Josh Trank.
The director,
suddenly threw a sickie. That day, that was quite a scramble behind the scenes, as far as I'm aware. Yeah, that was weird. And the guy who did show up, I'm forgetting everyone's name now. Godzilla director,
Gareth Edwards.
Yeah, he sort of seemed not too thrilled to be there either. I mean, he was pouring on the dry British wit a little too thick, I thought. You know, you need to be just a little bit more excited for this crowd. But you know, I think he's got it. I think he understands the Star Wars audience. I just don't think he was particularly happy to be there that day, and certainly not happy that Trank had left him alone on the stage.
Is Rian Johnson still scheduled to do one of the standalone films? Oh no, he's doing the next sequel, right?
He's doing Episode 8.
Yeah. Yes. Did he show up at Celebration?
He did not, no. I believe because Episode 8 was already in progress, and that was right around the time he had to go and film Mark Hamill on that Irish island, right, which has been the source of what people call a spoiler, but is not, you know, it's been fully reported in the media that Mark Hamill is doing recording for Episode 8 already, so...
Well, and that was where he was allegedly injured. Was that where some of that came in? Was that?
Yeah, apparently that bit was false. He may have tripped once on a path, and that suddenly becomes, you know, Harrison Ford level injury.
How long until rumors of the Star Wars curse start to permeate?
So I mean, you mentioned that it was a big rush around, you know, Josh Trank leaving. It seems like what Star Wars is building is a very Disney Marvel-esque kind of machine where, you know, everything has a place. Everything is written and rewritten within an inch of its life so it can get to the best stage possible. And that's what I was touching on before with the original script is – It feels like, and from what I've heard from behind the scenes of some of the Marvel movies and stuff like that, that like what anything that we hear is usually about 3 to 4 months delayed of decisions that were made quietly behind the scenes, but before stuff goes on. So it's like at the point that we heard that Michael Arndt was leaving as writer and JJ and Kasdan were going to be taking over, it seems like something that the more I've learned about that system, or at least the Marvel one, which it seems like Star Wars is taking the blueprint from, that's something that probably happened far closer to the sale than we were kind of led to believe. What have you seen from that machine as it you know, prepares to become this cultural force?
It's actually a little disturbing that they seem to have gone the opposite direction. I mean, they did wait a long time to replace Arndt, even though it seems that he was rather too slow on his script writing. And that was ultimately the reason why he was dropped from the project. But also, both JJ and Lawrence Kasdan have talked about the fact that they didn't even have the story in hand. Like, by the end of 2013, you know, they're about to start filming and they're still working on the story, which, you know, as soon as I heard them say that was a little disturbing. But at the same time, you know, we were just talking a little earlier off air about Doctor Who, and something else that was revealed on that this week was that awesome 50th anniversary Doctor Who that everyone loved. You know, that only fell into place like literally days beforehand. You know, they didn't get John Hurt as the special war doctor until right at the end. So,
hey,
you know,
the Hobbit trilogy came together last minute and that turned out fine.
Well, yeah.
LOL, JK.
It's interesting how much we're getting. It's like there's no statute of limitations on this stuff anymore. They just want to spill. You know, Peter Jackson just wants to talk about what a nightmare that shoot was and how close to the wire he was and how little he knew that he was doing. I hope that's a new...
And he gets to do that because despite that, they made, you know, billions of dollars, you know.
Well, yeah. And I guess that's the difference. If you are on a genuinely miserable shoot that makes no money and in a world where everybody has a social media output, everyone has their own megaphone, and you're the guy who talks about how bad the shoot is, you are the guy who's shouting sour grapes about a project that went bad. However, when a project makes a gajillion dollars, you're the guy talking about the reality of how difficult it is to make a beautiful piece of art.
Well, or even in the case, I think we're all referring to the Peter Jackson Hobbit behind the scenes thing that wound up making the blog runs there. But like, you know, there's a scene. I mean, as if not to put too fine a point on it, they have a shot of Peter Jackson in the throne room. Of course, the Hobbit is story spoilers for a book that came out a billion years ago. This shot here, you know, of him, you know, the story is about Oakenshield eventually being corrupted by gold after this grand journey. And this is like Peter Jackson in the spot of Oakenshield as this gigantic money grab, you know, on top of a fantastic, the defining trilogy of his career kind of crumbles around him due to ill preparation. Like it was. I thought that was remarkable. That was insane to see somebody do that.
I was. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Chris.
It was so refreshing because it's. I mean, this is what we wanted to hear from George Lucas around the prequels. I think, you know, and it's what we sort of objectively know about the prequels, that he was writing them. He was writing those scripts right up until I think 2 days before on Attack of the Clones, and like 3 days on Phantom Menace, and you know, it was. He was always going down to the wire, and he was always just coming up with new ideas the last minute, not giving it a rewrite, not giving it anyone else to polish.
And writing them in post, too. Transferring digital lips onto actors and, you know, oh, I'll have them say this. And you're like,
I know, exactly. Yeah, after the fact, changing the mouth movements after the fact. I mean, just all this stupid shit where we know, intuitively we know he didn't know what he was doing, but he just won't come out and say it in the way that Peter Jackson has. So I hope that this is a new kind of honesty in directing that we're seeing here.
Speaking of honest directors, Ron Howard came out on a podcast this week and mentioned that he, as well as Spielberg, and I forget who else, were approached by George Lucas to direct the prequels. You have a great anecdote in How Star Wars Conquered the Universe about Lucas coming to Kasdan with the script and Kasdan not touching it because, you know, if he wasn't going to let him change Anakin Skywalker from a baby to at the very least a teenager, if not somebody in his 20s, then he didn't want to, you know, want anything to do with it. What do you know about George's search for collaborators with the prequels and the ultimate result that nobody worked with him?
Well, he did work with a couple of writers on the Indiana Jones prequels, the TV show. But that was about it. And even then, it doesn't seem to have made much impact on the script. No, I mean, Lucas is and always has been something of a control freak. You know, he has his vision and it's absolutely set and no one is going to change it. And he did actually say that about Kasdan. I mean, the anecdote you're referring to is apparently, I think, several months before episode one was due to start shooting, he went to Kasdan and asked him to do a polish on the script. And that was reported at the time, and Kasdan said no, you know, George should go do his own thing. You know, which seemed reasonable at the time. You know, Lucas wrote the original Star Wars. He wrote episode four, so why shouldn't he write episode one? You know, you should do the beginning of every trilogy and set out your vision. But also, Lucas later on said, yeah, I realized that I didn't want Kasdan because he was telling me the same thing that everyone else was telling me, which is don't make Anakin Skywalker a 9-year-old. You know, which is the most obvious thing in hindsight.
What do you suppose it was that drove Lucas to insist on that so hard? You know, in the face of it, I understand, you know, artistic creation often comes in the face of what everyone tells you to do. Mm-hmm. But what was he thinking, I guess, in other words, as best you could tell?
Well, it was a little bit of that. I mean, you know, this is a guy whose first two films were slashed by the studios and, you know, he never recovered from that. But also, I think you've got to remember that he was a dad of three, And, you know, one of my favorite descriptions of George Lucas from insiders at Lucasfilm is just, you know, two words, geek dad. You know, this is the guy who he is. He basically, you know, there's a sense in which he made Phantom Menace for his kids. He wanted it to be relatable to his kids who were about that age at the time. And, yeah, you know, when you see the early drafts of Phantom Menace, it's so much smarter. Jar Jar Binks talks like Buddha. I mean, you know, and Anakin is this creepy little, you know, Christ child, which I think totally would have worked if you played it more like The Omen, you know, which seems that he originally did. And then he threw that script out and said, no, that's too grown up. That's too adult. I want this to be more for younger children.
Do you think it's a case where he committed the crime of trying to write for what he imagines kids would want, and in doing so just lost touch? I mean, that the beauty of Star Wars is that everything plays to adults. And, oh, by the way, kids love it because flashing lights and princesses and lightsaber duels.
Yeah, and he has talked over the years of the importance of trying to get into the fantasy life of a teenage girl. Like, you know, there's a huge untapped market. And that is indeed part of what he was thinking, apparently, with Strange Magic. Whereas, really, you know, it's what they, when you look at what they want, what they go see, it's more like, you know, they want Hunger Games. They want to be Katniss. You know, you want to be the best-dressed rebel in history. And, you know, I think what Lucas was thinking there was just way off base.
You know, so. And you go back and you watch – I just talked with this the woman who lives next door to me. Her little daughter dressed as Princess Leia for Halloween, and she's the one that tries to ambush the little boy who lives on the other side of me with a lightsaber. Like, there's, like, constant Star Wars battles here all the time. And I was talking to the mom, and she said, yeah, you know, I just watched the movie again and realized how badass Princess Leia is. Mm. And you look like, oh, yeah, like, she's the inciting incident. She's trying to escape with the plans. She gets caught, but she's not caught because she's a dainty princess that gets kidnapped. She's on this mission, and she's a soldier of war, basically captured. And then when her rescuers come, spoiler alert about Star Wars, you know, is they kind of have a half-assed plan, and she has to figure things out for them. And she's super proactive from there. And one of the strongest, you know, female, you know, you think, like, when did we first start seeing really strong female characters in science fiction? You know, it was two years later, we got Ellen Ripley in Alien. And I think that if you look at Carrie Fisher and the Princess Leia in Star Wars, and you go, man, that's a really strong character. And we did not see that even in the other – more of her as a romantic interest in Empire, more so in Jedi. And then in the prequels is, you know, we're given Amidala as this title. She's a senator, and she's giving speeches and stuff, but – it's more of a role than action.
She's a senator, but also a queen who was elected.
Yeah. who just throws Jar Jar in as her deputy when she has to head off and flirt with Anakin on Naboo. I mean, it's just crazy.
What could go wrong? I think we talked about it before. There's the YouTube cut that explains that Jar Jar is probably like the ultimate Sith master. And
yes. Yeah, I saw that theory floating around a lot and treated way more seriously than I think its author intended.
Oh, yeah, the guy who wrote it, you could tell it was tongue-in-cheek, you know, that it was a tongue. But it was funny that people didn't quite pick up his, you know.
I said this in the book. It's like, you know, it's almost what Lucas does to Jar Jar in Attack of the Clones is sort of like saying, oh, well, you think Jar Jar ruined the galaxy far, far away? Turned out he literally did.
Yeah. You
know, he was literally the one to propose the emergency powers. But, yeah, you know, it's funny. Going back to Princess Leia and the strong female character, so much of that comes from the fact that she just has these amazing one-liners. Right, you know, it's up until that point of the movie, Han Solo gets all the good one-liners, and then she comes along, and Luke walks into the cell, and she's like, "I need a little short for a stormtrooper."
Yeah.
All of that dialogue, none of it is Lucas. All of it is Willard Hike and Gloria Katz, you know, who really punched up that section of the film and really, you know, took Lucas's wordiness and turned it into these fantastic one-liners.
In your book, and I cannot recommend his book again. It's How Star Wars Conquered the Universe. He goes through – Chris goes through every iteration of that script. And if you're an artist and you want to create something and you want to see what it takes to – you know, where did this thing start from? And what would have happened? What would the Star Wars be if, you know, Lucas had his own way? If you pick up, there's a graphic novel right now called The Star Wars, which you read this thing and it is the worst Dune Flash Gordon fanfic you've ever seen.
Oh yeah,
and that's with a polish put on it. I mean, it was written by Jonathan Renslow, who did all the making of Star Wars books, and you know, and he's a Lucasfilm guy, and he's going to put the best possible spin on this original script for Star Wars, and even he can't polish this turd.
So
I think my favorite part about that, and then we can go to your question, Brian, is just the dead Gandalf rip that Obi-Wan, you know, initially was, that he's just like almost like, you know, just like the Kmart Gandalf lines from The Hobbit that, yes, you know, he has when he first meets Luke.
When he was Ben Kenobi, before he was Obi-Wan, he was this sort of giggling Gandalf character, literally lifting lines from The Hobbit.
So before we move on, I just want to speak to the legacy of Princess Leia as a fantastic feminist character. You know, that we hear echoes of this all the way down to recently Star Wars Battlefront came out. And on the Rebels side, when you get the benefit of being one of the big heroes, one of the massively overpowered characters, there's three characters. You could be Han Solo, Luke Skywalker, or Princess Leia, right? Likewise, we also see Disney distancing itself. You know, I think there was an article, I don't know if it's BS or not, of Disney saying that they're going to wind down any kind of merchandising or imagery of Leia in the slave outfit. Is that what do you think that speaks to as far as is that some over PC-ness, or what's the motivation behind that?
Well, I mean, there was a bit of a kerfuffle this summer when parents, I believe, in Philadelphia went to a Target there, and they saw that the only Leia merchandise was little slave Leia figures, and they felt uncomfortable having to explain that to their kids. And there was a Lego Star Wars movie where the cover was just, you know, everyone was wearing their clothes except Leia, you know, and some kids were asking their parents, like, why is Leia the only one who's in a bikini here?
And the parents Chewbacca's were like, naked, guys.
I mean, he does have a bandolier.
He's got the belt.
I don't want to bring that up, but yeah, he's actually bald underneath all of that.
Yeah.
No.
Jabba naked.
At the same time, there was a movement among the fans to rename Slave Leia as Slayer Leia. You know, not
Slayer,
you know,
Leia.
Yeah.
Oh, Slayer, because she Slayer. Does murder a sentient being in that outfit. That's a good point.
Exactly. And it's not about her being a slave. It's about her being positive. And
it's better than them just doing the reverse find and replace on Huck Finn.
Yeah, it is sort of a little bit of whitewashing history. But at the same time, I mean, you got to remember, around Return of the Jedi, you know, Leia's character, I know Carrie Fisher said that she felt completely divorced from Leia's character by that point, that she asked for something more from her, something real, something she could relate to, something that just sort of suggested the post-traumatic stress of having a planet full of billions of people annihilated in front of you and no one ever mentioned it again. You know, and then she gets a bikini instead of that. So I'm like, yeah, okay.
You watch Star Wars and you look at, you know, when she's consoling Luke because his, you know, his aunt and uncle died, and you know, Ben just died, and the aunt and uncle, that was like hours ago, you know, and then she's like, ah, you poor guy, and he's like, yeah, it's all about me. You wouldn't understand, you know.
Yeah, it's not like I'm the reason for an entire planet's genocide because I decided to play chicken and call the bluff of an Imperial Empire with a super weapon. Like, oh yeah, look at me.
That is that great, you know, Robot Chicken sketch where they have Carrie Fisher say exactly what Leia should have said in that scene. Oh, I'm sorry. Did the 80-year-old man who died yesterday, who you just met yesterday, just die? I didn't notice. I was getting over the murder of 4 billion people on my planet, you know. Which is just all this stuff where you stop and think about it in Star Wars. It's like, wow, there are two genocides in the original movie. That's a bit weird. But, you know, it just goes so fast, you don't even get time to think about this stuff. But Leia was supposed to have a command in the in Return of the Jedi. Instead of just going to the moon of Endor and, you know, meeting Ewoks, she was supposed to be in charge of that mission. And then they give it to General Solo, who has done way less for the rebellion than she has. So, so I can see the concern about the bikini and I can see that the reason why they've decided to make her General Organa, in the new movie.
I mean, do you think it's a case where, you know, in 2015 it just seems a little bit silly to, like, we see that. I could hear somebody make a case that in 1983 or 82, I forget when, audiences wouldn't have been ready to see, you know, a female commanding a regiment or whatever. But is it a case that in 2015, not only are we ready for it, but we think it's weird that she wasn't?
Mm. Yeah, now it looks weird that she got passed out. But it's like this evolving thing. Like in 1977, it didn't seem weird that Chewbacca didn't get a medal.
Yes, that's,
you know,
true.
And now it's one of the first things that people point to.
It took the MTV Music Awards, the MTV Movie Awards to fix that.
He wasn't the captain of the vessel, which, I'm sorry, guys.
But it was also, I mean, in 1977, you still had people who saw the scene with the bartender telling the droids to wait outside. We don't serve that kind in here. You know, and that was still something.
I mean, but that's legit. I mean, droids
are
a-holes.
You know what's funny about that scene? 30 seconds before, C-3PO is upset about the Jawas fondling the land speeder, and he calls them disgusting creatures. And then we get him all of a sudden getting kicked out of the place. So I don't know if that was intentional or not, but that's kind of cool that he's prejudiced against them. They're like, oh, no, you can't come in here.
You go ahead and try bringing your Roomba into a bar in Oakland and see whether or not they take kindly to it. They'll make you bring that thing right out.
They don't even accept Google Glass. Then I got to.
No, God, no.
You know what? That is a weird parallel where it's like, you're right. I mean, it's like that really puts into stark contrast the fact that they really did regard, I mean, rightly so, droids as equipment. And it's like, don't bring your filthy Google Glass in here. We're a classy upscale hipster joint in the middle of the villainous hive of scum and villainy.
That's right. The cantina is hipster joint. It just suddenly all makes sense. That's why they're playing old swing music.
That's right. That's right.
No, definitely. It was, you know, they should CGI PBR into put a few mustaches on him.
Yeah. Yeah. Stick some DJs in there, like ready to play that.
No, that's what he's talking about. When he says he has the death sentence, you know, like that means, you know, it's a really cool band.
That's his upcoming mixtape he's talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. It's actually an account on SoundCloud. His friend
before
does.
It was cool.
Yeah. okay, so man, we're running. We're just barreling through this.
I got a non-Star Wars bit of news.
Okay,
well, here, hold on. Before we get to that, let's remind everybody: Patreon.com/weirdthings is where you can support this very, very program, and let us know that you appreciate us bringing top tier authors like Chris on the program. Patreon.com/weirdthings. Thank you to everybody who is supporting now, and everybody who will support in the future. You guys are the best.
Popular authors like Chris Taylor and only Chris Taylor
appear on the show.
That's fine. That's all we need, baby.
I can appear in a win.
So we had an exciting development this week in the realm of space exploration. The very, very stealthy company Blue Origin, which is being bankrolled by Jeff Bezos, who... you know, there's not a lot of information about the company itself. They're supposed to have some amazing headquarters in Seattle, where apparently, you know, somebody doing research onto this went and dug through trash cans and stuff and was able to find out some of the backstory on, you know, what they're working on. They're supposed to have a giant Jules Verne spaceship in the lobby. And what Bezos has been doing with Blue Origin is they've been trying to develop their own rocket engines and their own delivery vehicles, and they have their own plan to space. And the first thing that they want to do, it looks like it's more aimed towards space tourism, is a single stage rocket. And they did a first. They had the first single stage upright vertical rocket. There's so many qualifiers in there, but it's really significant. They had a rocket called the New Shepard, which took off from its launch pad in Texas, went up to the quote space barrier, which is like 70 miles up, and then detached its little capsule, which then parachuted. There was some question, was it damaged or not? And then the rocket, the main body, then landed back down on Earth. And it is an amazing achievement. And there were a lot of comparisons that were made to what SpaceX was done, which isn't really fair to either company, because what Blue Origin did was significant. It absolutely is very, very – and that's Emily Calandrelli, who we had on our show when I was at the the CTS launch.
MCAL Space Gal, our friend on Twitter, yeah.
Yeah. So anyhow, the difference is that what SpaceX is doing is they're trying to send a rocket into, make it go orbital, and they have a much larger rocket that has to go up and then go basically horizontal over the horizon and then flip back down and land back down into, at first at the ocean, which they've done soft landings on a landing pad. It's a very, very different challenge. It's going Mach, you know, 5 or 6 or something versus this, which is going Mach 1. Both are really cool. We live in a world where we have awesome companies creating really cool things. The only check mark against Blue Origin was, you know, they filed a patent on the use of barges to retrieve rockets, and they were going to try to block SpaceX from doing that, but SpaceX got that overturned. So that's the, it's kind of my one little
crit. Okay, all right. Everything is great. This is exciting. Private space travel, period. Let's appreciate that for what it is as we return, new paragraph. Billionaire fight!
Yes.
Gather around as two egomaniacal, brilliant genius billionaires snipe at each other on Twitter. This was handled by Amazon, or sorry, by Blue Origin and Jeff Bezos very much, both subliminally and out in your face.
Both subliminally and sublatantly.
Yes. That was not a subtweet by any stretch of the imagination.
The way that Bezos announced this on Twitter is in our hangar sits the rarest of beasts, a rocket that we can reuse and is just ready to gas up again. Number one, the fact that their announcement centered on the fact that they landed a rocket that went to space, very much positioned PR-wise as a first and something that needs to be recognized. And specifically, the unsaid is the first that SpaceX didn't do first. And the rarest of beasts, if you remember, it was Elon Musk that said it was more likely that unicorns would be dancing around the launch pads than a Blue Origin reusable rocket.
Wait. Let's qualify that. There was an argument. There was a dispute over launch pad 39B in Cape Canaveral, and SpaceX wanted to have the lease on it. And Blue Origin said, no, we want the lease. We want this. We challenge your lease. Blue Origin went in there and tried to get into their SpaceX business and said, no, we want to do this. And that's when Elon Musk says, I will sooner believe there will be a unicorn dancing in the exhaust on that launch pad by the time you guys are ready to put a rocket off from Canaveral over there.
Yes.
Blue Origin has been testing these other things. They already blew up one of their rockets up, and at least one rocket up there. And so this is the same part of Texas or roundabouts where SpaceX have been doing their Grasshopper launches years ago. So
yes, it's, I mean, but that's and thank you for providing context. That's if one were to say that Jeff Bezos wanted to get all up in Elon's business, using the term rarest of beasts after, you know, he used the unicorn thing, might be one way to do it. Who knows whether or not that's true? What is absolutely true is that Elon Musk did not take these tweets lying down and had the following quote, not quite rarest, quote unquote, SpaceX Grasshopper rocket did 6 suborbital flights 3 years ago and is still around. Which I think, again, we are team Brad stuff in space. That's what we are for. We are very excited by everything that happens in that realm. Aside from the brilliant advancement in space, I don't think it was either of those men's personal finest hour to get into what seems to be a bit of a public slap fight.
Well, and also just a poorly written one as well. It's like at the moment of your genuine triumph, Bezos, are you sure what you want to do? How many drafts do you think he did before you figure out the right way to throw a veiled in your face to Elon Musk? And I suspect Elon had exactly 0 drafts in his rebuttal because it smacks of like, nuh-uh. I mean, that's it.
And a big part of this, I think, too, was fueled by the idiotic coverage that it got when it happened, when you had, you know, every Verge, some of the other ones, the first ones to cover it. I'm sure Mashable had fine coverage. I'm absolutely sure. Everybody else, the person covering it, didn't want to know, explain the grasshopper, didn't understand the context of it, and had to be corrected in their comments by people going, well, no, actually, SpaceX did this. The X-15 was reusable, da-da-da-da-da, and then why are you covering this thing? You know, and it was just the trash talk that was in the headlines that should not have been there.
Well, no, I mean, let's talk real man-to-man talk here. I mean, it's clear when you look at the videos of both of those launch and landing vehicles, it's clear that Musk has the length, but Bezos has more girth. It's
much smaller,
girthy.
Ryan. Much smaller.
Oh, is it? Okay, that's not clear from the photos or my fantasies.
There's not much in it, too. All it can do is maybe go up for like a little bit, and then it just falls back down.
I see. Okay, you know? I see.
You know, I kept thinking when this news was announced, I kept thinking of the scene in Austin Powers.
Oh, yes.
The whole thing at the end with the rocket that looks like a Johnson.
Yeah, yes. Yes.
Love that scene. That's exactly what this looks like. I mean, even when you look at the images of the new Shepard rocket, which is just, you know, aerodynamically and unfortunately shaped.
It's the Blue Origin of the species.
Yeah. And in fact, our excellent Mashable coverage by the excellent Miriam Kramer, formerly of space.com, who really knows what she's talking about, was still headlined, Elon Musk is trying to bait Jeff Bezos into a rocket measuring contest.
Ah, accurate.
I think we do need this, though. I think that this is the sort of stuff that gets people actually interested in the private space race, and, you know, much rather this than dry statistics about rockets, right?
My frustration as a person who consumes so much of this was the bad science writing, the bad technical writing of not knowing what was at stake here, and then but getting excited about the fight, and then we kind of lose the achievement, and you get people going, well, SpaceX, I'm wearing a SpaceX hat. I'm very, very pro SpaceX, but I'm also excited to know more about what Blue Origin's doing. I'm rooting for them. I'm rooting for all of them, but when I see people who should know better covering it, who are not doing their job, mm-hmm. and then we kind of lose, and it becomes very, very quickly where we then our interest will fall once we move on to some other, you know.
And I'm sure this would never happen at Mashable, but what I am positive does happen in many other sites that write at the kind of volume that many of these sites write at, is what you are effectively looking at is an email comes in, a press release email comes in from Blue Origin. And people are rewriting the facts and the quotes from that PR email and then finding the most provocative headline that you can put on top of it. And, you know, I think the where we are in a very fortunate position is that amazing space exploration companies have savvy PR departments for which they are using to trumpet their achievements and take veiled slaps at their rivals. But if you are just rewriting the press release, then what you are saying are things like first and never done before and the language that is right there in the PR email that might not really be true. You know, is something
and just 5 minutes of Googling would give you a better article. Yeah, I know exactly the kind of trend in journalism that you're talking about, and it is disreputable, and you know, I really wish that people would pay more attention and have more pride in what they're writing a lot of times. That's certainly what I try to bring to the party.
But also, I think it's fine to acknowledge that it's the nature of our current society. I don't know if you happen to read Ryan Holiday's wonderful book, Trust Me, I'm Lying, where he talks about when he worked for American Apparel, he took advantage of the fact that he knew that bloggers needed to post 5, 6, 7, 12 times a day and that they didn't have time to fact check, and he would do what he called trading up the chain, posting an article at the least reputable blogs and then sending emails to slightly more reputable local news stations, and then up and up and up and hopefully hit, you know, the likes of Mashable, Gizmodo, and so on. And then before you know it, you're on the Wall Street Journal. I think that's just an artifact of what I think on balance is a wholly positive aspect of our information ecosystem right now, thanks to the internet, is the speed at which stuff goes. But an unfortunate side effect is that you do have overworked bloggers who just need to push stuff out.
I mean, with the understanding that there are surely right now 18-year-olds that are being ripped off the streets of Brooklyn and chained in cubicles at Gawker headquarters, where and only when they hit their page view count will they be given a sandwich to continue their work. You know,
the ironic thing though is that you, if you do a, you know, a well researched story, better researched story that has its own definitive point of view and a voice to it and a sense of authority to it, that actually gets more page views than your initial quick hit.
And, you know, and brand names in terms of these blogs matter, you know, and I think that, that, you know, a Mashable has a defined brand that has come from a certain kind of reporting. Gawker, as much as we make fun of them, you know, have a very defined brand from what they've done. Vice the same way. And I think that you've seen those, or even, you know, BuzzFeed for as superfluous as so much of their content can be, has distinguished themselves specifically when it comes to politics and stuff like that by hiring good people and doing good work, you know, based on that, that has kind of done more to fill out why people are paying attention to them than just the idea that something gets there quicker. Because now, if you're a blog, you're driving the slower car on the information superhighway compared to Twitter and Facebook and stuff like that now.
Right, and you can get torn apart by Twitter and Facebook, so it's extra important to have your facts straight. Yeah, you know, it's I see what the temptation is, but you know, also the good news that I can bring back from the front lines is it does actually make more financial sense to write a better story because you do get more page views in the long run, and you know, it makes more financial sense to get a better headline rather than a clickbait headline because you want your viewers to be, your readers to be happy when they click on the story and not feel cheated. I mean, I sort of, you know, I keep talking about this term hate click, you know, which is, I think, what people do a lot. They click on a story because they were clickbaited by the headline. They're like, oh, that's not, that wasn't worth it. And then they're going to, whatever site that did that, Upworthy, is probably not something that's, they're going to, you know, and you do see those sites that their audience tends to drop off after a while.
And it's funny because you see many of those sites that have enjoyed the wave of success that comes with, you know, the initial wave of clickbait headlines. You know, I'm thinking of BuzzFeed myself. I can't, you probably, never mind. I think of BuzzFeed and I see them trying very hard to legitimize themselves as a news source, but I don't know that they're ever going to cross that chasm in my mind. You know, they're never going to be, you know, a Wall Street Journal or a Mashable or a, you know, a Vice.com or any of that stuff, you know?
Well, yeah, you got to get the balance right. And I think, you know, BuzzFeed does great reporting, but they also do, you know, so many quizzes and so many, you know, so many GIF related posts that it's not quite the right balance yet. I'm sure we'll get there.
I saw, I've been doing a lot of research in the books space and seeing, you know, what's going on with some of the different people who popularize books and stuff. And it was interesting is, you know, BookBub, which has actually, I was a BookBub featured book yesterday and a book just shot up, of course, because of that. I want to know what their Twitter feed was like. I'm like, what is this? Like, this is the number one book recommendation list. What does their Twitter feed look like? And it's all like this BuzzFeed meme crap stuff of like, you know, just GIFs and stuff. And I said, man, is this what's happening where we look at what the number one most traffic things and it's all becoming listicles and stuff. And, you know, now we're it's going through the feed right here. And it's just this, it's not, hey, here's the top pick of the day book wise or whatever. It's, you know, eight series that are, you know, as hot as 50 Shades of Grey. And then, you know, what your reaction is when you finish your favorite book series and it's Barney from, you know, How I Met Your Mother. And it's just all of this, you know, listicle crap.
Yeah, and you could, I mean that stuff is good, but you got to balance it out. You know, it's, you can't have a meal that is all dessert.
Well, and the good news, I think you have the right point, Chris, which is like the fundamentals have shifted so that even if you are a pragmatic player purely on the game theory now says you're better off investing in more insight and better research to build your brand as a trustworthy source, because we see the backlash against that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
So, Chris, we're not going to do picks because we all have the same pick. It's called How Star Wars Conquered the Universe. We might have extra picks, but our main pick is seriously your book. It's about 30 hours on audio, and I probably lost 5 or 6 pounds just walking around at night, staying out longer to walk extra laps just so I could listen to the next chapter or whatever. I may be prone to hyperbole, but there is no amount of hyperbole that can articulate how much I really enjoyed that book. And What? Any hint on what you're doing next?
Thank you. That's awesome to hear. I've actually heard that people like the audiobook so much. They've told me they've driven around in circles around Lake Tahoe. You know, that's what I get occasionally. It's not locked in yet, but I think I spoke to this the last time I was on, that I wanted to do a book about utopia versus dystopia.
Cool.
And, that is a much more, you know, that is a proposal now. You know, it is much a much firmer stage than it was, but it's basically the same idea that, you know, trying to discover what is it about us that we love dystopian fiction in all its forms. We love post-apocalyptic, zombie-based, or Hunger Games-style fiction. It just seems to have taken over the world in the last few years. And what is it about utopia that we hate, that we can't seem to latch onto? And what would it take to write a modern utopia? And part of the book attempts to do exactly that, to construct a feasible modern utopian narrative that would work for the millennial generation. So stay tuned.
I just want to fish for insights on this, because this is something that fascinates me. It seems like in so many ways, you know, as a fringy political person, it seems like so much of utopia is built around the idea of central planning, everything with a consistent look and aesthetic feel, clearly designed by architects. And then what's often represented as dystopia, for example, you know, Blade Runner universe, Snow Crash, Neal Stephenson's Snow Crash. Neal Stephenson's Snow Crash is clearly written to horrify the reader as to the broken dystopian nature of it. And yet I love it. I adore it. It's a place where everything they franchise citizenship in different fast food establishments. And, you pay in various currencies. Everything's decentralized. Do you notice any trends, or is that all? Do I have to wait for the book to hear about this?
No, that is exactly right. That's one of the biggest problems is that dystopias have all the fun.
Yes. I mean, internet.
To your point, though, the biggest dystopian franchise is Hunger Games, and that is all central planning gone awry, right? That it is a central government that has taken us to this horrifying place.
I wonder
if it's a central government that knows to have bread and circuses, right? You know, that's the whole point of the Hunger Games themselves, is to keep the populace both terrified and entertained.
Go ahead.
Well, yeah, and in your book, getting back to theirs, you know, you talked about, you know, exploring the question of, did Star Wars inspire like Star Trek did? And I would come from the point of view that the people that were inspired by Star Trek, who liked that, you know, were the ones that went to work for NASA. The ones that were inspired by Star Wars were the Elon Musks and Jeff Bezos was a big Star Trek fan, but were often the ones that wanted to go create their own Millennium Falcon, go out there and create their own world, because they didn't want the universe with rules. They wanted the ones without one, because that was where the fun was to be had.
Yeah, and it's definitely a problem if you try to create a utopia on screen. I don't know if you guys have seen Chaos on the Bridge, William Shatner's documentary about Gene Roddenberry coming back to Star Trek and creating the Next Generation and the infighting on that. It's now on Netflix. It's an hour-long documentary. I recommend that everyone watch it, because that was the essential piece of the conflict, was that Gene thought that in the 24th century there would be no interpersonal conflict, because we've resolved, you know, there's no need to fight about anything because we've solved world hunger, we've solved energy problems, and we can all just be big happy families on spaceships. Well, you know, and that is the problem. That's why people don't trust utopian visions these days.
Yeah,
because just doesn't feel right. Families have conflicts.
Federation's a fascist enterprise anyway, so
it's evident in Star Wars as well. I may have talked about this before, but you know, the more popular Star Wars movies revolve around a dystopian empire rather than a utopian galactic republic.
All right, so let's just say theoretically blue sky in it. Of course, you know, this utopian dystopian book lights everything up, and Star Wars, again, you know, projecting, who knows, turns out to be very popular and is huge and gigantic. And there is now a desire from your publisher for you to do a sequel or a story on where Star Wars has gone. What would you find to be the most fascinating story about Star Wars, the current fandom or the machine that is putting this stuff out that you would like to dig in on?
You know, what I've been fascinated throughout the book, and by the way, the intent with this book was never to have a sequel. It was always going to be the one volume history of Star Wars, and I may add chapters to it. In the paperback version, has a whole extra chapter on the creation of The Force Awakens. So, you know, I hope that I can keep that going, and that, you know, next year we'll have an extra chapter on Rogue One. And you know, I would love it if you bought it now and then, you know, on Kindle, and then you could get the extra chapter when it gets delivered. But we'll have to see about that. But in any case, what has always fascinated me, and this is evident throughout the book, is this notion of the idea of Star Wars being something that was spawned from George Lucas's brain, but really now exists by itself and has sort of transmitted itself to other brains. And that the story of the prequels was the story of us telling George Lucas, no, that's not Star Wars. That's not what we had in mind. And he was like, no, this is what I had in mind. You know, goofy monsters, more spaceships, more models, more big budget, fill the screen with all the things. And we're like, no, that's not what we saw. Sorry, thank you. You know, and J.J. Abrams comes along and says, yes, I agree with you. Star Wars is more of a Western. You know, now he's imposing the audience's vision on Star Wars, which is fascinating. That, you know, that this thing has a life of its own. You can almost feel it as this meme that leaves George Lucas's head, enters J.J. Abrams, enters the, you know, billions of people around the world. What happens to that next? I mean, now that idea, now it's a $4 billion idea owned by Disney, right? And they're probably going to make their money back just on the merchandising from the first film alone. But, you know, what happens to that next? How long can that idea live? I raise the question in the book, are we still going to be seeing Star Wars movies in 100 years? And I think because the general idea of Star Wars is so strong, and because it is in better hands now than its creator, I think that it possibly can, and I'm fascinated to see how long it can go.
I think that part of the reason why that is that the reason Star Wars worked is it took a lot of very familiar ideas, a lot of good ideas in science fiction, and figured out how to make them work on the screen. And you can't do, you know, why did Disney buy Star Wars? It's because they wanted it. They could have created their own space galaxy spanning adventure. It's hard to not run up against Star Wars. And even within the Marvel Universe, Guardians of the Galaxy, part of the reasons we loved it is it was very Star Wars-like. And, you know, and it ultimately you can keep saying, well, how, and it's like, it's where Harry Potter is now. If you want to do something in the world of magic and contemporary and have witches and wizards and stuff, guess what? You're always going to be compared to Harry Potter. It's going to be hard to get away with it. You can say we're doing more grown-up versions and stuff like with the magicians or whatever, but it's going to be – it's either Harry Potter or it's Harry Potter light. And Harry Potter took, you know, a bunch of neat ideas and stuff that was out there, and she – J.K. Rowling did a wonderful way of packaging it and making it all work and cohesive and a bit more palatable than, let's say, the wonderful Discworld series is and all that. And you can find elements of that elsewhere, and I think that's – I think there's a lot riding on Rogue One, kind of like in the Marvel Universe was, if you could make – you could do Iron Man. If you could make Thor work with gods and stuff like that and then go all the way out there at Guardians of the Galaxy, you've got a franchise. And if we're into this space commando mission with Rogue One, and how weird is it that, like, how many people are more excited about that, by the way, than Force Awakens? And it's a prequel.
Yep. And it's it's basically Saving Private Ryan meets Star Wars, which – is a fascinating way to do it, and I think proves the fact that, you know, this idea is so mutable. You know, you can take it in so many different directions and have it still essentially be Star Wars. That I think that, yeah, you're right. Rogue One is going to prove that. I think we're going to see more along those lines. I think we may see more experimentation in the spin-off movies, perhaps make one more of a rom-com, you know, set in the Star Wars universe. Who knows?
I could totally see that, man.
It's a big galaxy.
Okay, so I know we're starting to run long here, so there's one important burning question on everyone's mind. This December, will Star Wars make more money than any other movie within the first 30 days of its release? And it's very important for a very specific reason. That's at draft.nightattack.tv.
I believe it will.
I'm sorry, draft.diamondclub.tv. So specifically, like, I guess the biggest one right now is it still Avatar right now, released around the same time, 3-4 years ago?
Yeah, 2.7 billion, I believe.
Yeah, that's the worldwide. Domestic was, what, 750 million. If you were going to put a number on the domestic for this, by the end of, we'll say, January, what would you guess?
And by the way, one of the big stories this week was that tracking first started to hit for what people are expecting Star Wars to make based on its awareness in all four quadrants, which, as you might imagine, is gigantic. And the tracking ranges from the heartbreaking disappointment of only being the biggest December movie of all time at the low 200s. To the insanity, like, people would sacrifice the leading star of movies at an altar if it was guaranteed for the entire run to just be what is projected to be the optimistic Star Wars opening of 300 million. Where do you think this ends up landing with the opening weekend and then going on for the domestic gross?
I'm gonna put it out there and guess 250 for opening weekend. And total domestic, I think it could even hit a billion. I think there's that much interest, there's that much repeatability in this. You know, if J.J. Abrams has got it right, I mean, here's a kid who saw the original Star Wars over and over again in the Avco Theater in Hollywood. So he knows that it's, you know, part of what is essential to this is you need to be able to go back and see it 4 or 5 times. There needs to be nothing in it that prevents that. It needs to be, you know, the eye candy needs to be good enough. I think that we've seen that in the trailers. It obviously is. You know, the trailers are just somewhere you want to climb inside those trailers and live there, right?
Man,
it just
looks so gorgeous. In the current age, you know, in the old days, there was no way to relive your favorite moments of Star Wars. You had to go back and buy a ticket and sit through the whole thing again just for that one moment of the Death Star blowing up. But it occurs to me that,
spoilers, Brian.
Yeah, sorry. I totally would not put it past J.J. Abrams to realize that in the 21st century, the only way you get people to go watch the movie again is if you do something like set up a secret narrative that only takes place in the background of shots every 5 minutes, so that, you know, 3 weeks after it comes out, this leaks out and we're like, wait, there's a whole nother story in there that I missed. And you go back and you watch, and then you have this weird moment where the audience, one half of the audience is reacting to the A plot, the other is reacting and watching to this B story that was secretly grafted into it. That would be amazing.
We've already seen, I mean, they are sneaking so many Easter eggs into this thing. We've already seen, you know, the little Mandalorian flag, you know, the Boba Fett's people. There's a prayer flag in one scene where Han and Finn are going into this temple-like place. And you see that little Mandalorian flag up there. You know, people pick that apart. They love that sort of stuff. You know, the fact that 3PO has a different colored arm, you know, and there's a whole backstory there. So it really seems like they're getting into that, exactly that concept that you're talking about, which is part of what brought people back for Star Wars. Like, what is the Clone Wars that he's talking about? You know, what did happen to Obi-Wan?
The repeatability comes down to also is like scene length. If you break down the most repeatable, rewatchable films that tend to come from, like, say, Lucas and Spielberg, you take Raiders of the Lost Ark, and you realize how there were these action sequence payoffs every 20 minutes, you know, and how you had, you know, going from there's almost a rhythm from, like, there's a twofold conflict to a threefold conflict to a fourfold conflict. There are a lot of these sort of almost mathematics that would apply to it. But, you know, overall, it's having those great character moments and filling the screen with very interesting people. And I remember being this far out from Phantom Menace going, well, you know, it's Liam Neeson. You know, he's always done good stuff.
They had no backstory with the Phantom Menace. It's like, you know, all they had was trade disputes, yes. Right? Who cares about the backstory of trade disputes? But already with The Force Awakens, you've got, like, what the hell has happened to the Empire and the Rebellion? Now they're the First Order and the Resistance. So obviously a lot of shit has gone down in the last 30 years. You know, and you're going to want to pick it apart for that.
Meanwhile, behind the scenes, you have J.J. Abrams, which, I mean, I'm just personally taking as if he's just talking to me personally when he says things like, yeah, you know, the Super 8 script wasn't ready and we kind of screwed that up. And we kind of screwed up Star Trek Into Darkness because we made too many winks and nods to Wrath of Khan, where it's like, I think Andrew and I have talked at length about, you know, kind of like, okay, so let's prepare ourselves. Let's build our armor for, you know, like where it might not be the movie that we want it to be. And ultimately it's, is it too referential? Where is it too obsessed with winks and nods to the fact that this is a Star Wars movie, and it gets in its own way there, or if it is just a series of setups that don't give us a satisfying conclusion to hook us into a series of three big movies, and instead we just get a Prometheus where it's like a bunch of lukewarm, you know, half interesting questions that we're just going to trust you guys will reveal interesting answers for in the next movie, even though you certainly didn't do it here.
And if it was just J.J. Abrams involved in the writing, I think I would agree that that's a danger, that he has certain excesses that he repeats. And, you know, he has a tendency to pick stuff up and then sort of leave it lying all over the place. But the fact that Karazdan is there, you know, that he has the track record that he has, and he, you know, that guy just lives and breathes, you know, good script. I mean, well, you know, this is Raiders of the Lost Ark
getting pulled into it.
Sorry, what was that, Andrew?
What's it? So I guess his son is like his writing partner now, or I guess that's he's going to, I guess, take over on the next one or something there.
I think they're writing the Han Solo spinoff together. That was the idea. And then Karazdan's going to bow out at that stage.
Yeah, no, I believe Rian Johnson is writing or has written episode eight.
Right,
I believe so. And you know, and then after that we get the Han Solo spinoff, still unnamed, and then Kazan Solo at that stage.
Solo.
They should just call it Han Solo shot first, and then everyone will go see it.
Yeah. It's funny, like I've seen George Lucas wearing that shirt too.
Yep. Yeah, and I've also seen fans point out that you know, they're trying to appropriate the controversy by making it a Han shot first controversy, rather than, you know, the whole point being that Han shot by himself. You know, Greedo didn't shoot at all, so we shouldn't call it that. You know, so, but yeah, fans get bent out of shape for a lot.
Again, the book is How Star Wars Conquered the Universe. Chris, thank you again for taking time to chat with us about this. I think what's going to happen right now is we will all just text you our phone numbers, and I want a one emoji review after you see it on the 14th, because you're going to be there at the premiere. I just want just one emoji.
Well, like, I mean, actually, just really as a courtesy to all of the people around you in the theater, it occurs to me that, you know, there might be an incoming call that would unfortunately make your phone vibrate. To prevent that, you could be on the line with someone and just set your phone down with the screen off. Then if anyone were to call you, it wouldn't disturb your neighbors. So if you wanted to call me or Justin or Andrew and just set that phone down, it's fine by us.
Yeah, you know, Justin has a Google Glass, which hardly used.
I think I might be ripped bodily from the audience.
Tell them you're Lobot. You're Lobot.
Yeah. No, that'd be the surest fire way that you could get first person perspective footage of J.J. Abrams scissor kicking you in the head to, you know, so shatter your Google Glass.
I have to wear it. It's a disability.
Chris, have you had a chance to go to Disneyland and see any of the Season of the Force stuff?
Not yet. No, have you?
Yes. Yeah, I was brought to tears, basically. They do it. They have a 22-minute I think it's called Path of the Jedi or the Journey of the Jedi, and it's this a montage of all these early clips, and then it ends with the Force Awakens trailer. And the amount of emotion and the amount of stuff that goes into that is just I feel very, very good, and I'm trying to temper my expectations. I just want a good movie. I just want to go in there. It doesn't even have to be the best movie of the year, you know. It just has to be a solid movie, and given the fact that, you know, I saw the Captain America Civil War trailer, you know, best movie of the year is going to be kind of hard for Star Wars to take. But
yeah, low expectations is good. We learned that from Phantom Menace, so definitely go with that. But in deference to you guys, I'm going to tweet out a one emoji review after I see the film.
Good.
And you know, I'm almost certain it will not be the poop emoji.
Oh, God. Right on.
We'll be like, but you know, maybe that's an alien. Maybe it's a good alien. It's a smiling alien, guys. We'll exactly. do the same stages of denial of Phantom Menace.
Listen, man, you're just going to see the world, Twitter tear itself apart as you tweet out the enigmatic two girls ballet dancing together emoji. And
this is how I feel inside right now. I haven't seen this film.
thank you so much for coming on, Chris. The book is fantastic. Everybody needs to go pick it up if you haven't read it already. And we are all we're resisting physical violence with how jealous we are that you get to see this movie 3 days before we do.
I forgive you because you know there are a few books that you read that you feel that they're a gift in a sense that the amount of time and effort the writer put into it and how they could have delivered something that was half as much and you'd still like it, but how much you put into how Star Wars conquered the universe. I am seriously in awe of that book. I love that book. And I really do. I pitch that book to everybody as far as, you know, what they should read on the subject and just in general, not even about Star Wars, but just understanding how, you know, how to cover a topic as expansive as that is. So
absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you, Andrew. My ears are burning right now. You can't even see, but
good. I appreciate it. The headphones, you should probably clean them. Gentlemen, it's been awesome with Chris Taylor.
Yeah.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.